So I'll tell you a little bit about Pauline Yates. She was born and educated in the UK, where she studied philosophy, art, and design. Her home is in East Hampton, New York, where she founded and runs Sane World, Sane Planet, an environmental social entrepreneurship. Pauline began writing poetry in her 20s, receiving encouragement and mentoring from New York poets Kenneth Koch and Barbara Guest. Her new book of poems, Gasping at Beauty, is scheduled for release in fall 2018, and you can reach her at info@saneworld.io. Welcome, Pauline Yates.
Dee asked me to say a few words about poets and poetry. First of all, there's not much I can say about poetry because it's such a massive subject, but about poets. It takes a certain kind, a few things to be a poet. It takes a certain kind of authority, a self-authority, self-declared authority to be a poet, to sort of make a statement that what you say matters and you have something to say that's worthy of something. So it takes a certain ownership of your own authority to actually write something down and have other people listen to it or read it. And the particular thing about poets is, in other kinds of writing, most other kinds of writing, an observation, the object is really the focus of the exchange. With the poet, it's either the observer, the poet, or it's a reflexive relationship between the poet and what they're observing. So the poet's vantage point is always present. And really what we're looking for with poets is the vantage point. It's really what they bring to the party, what they have to say about their world, and what they have to share with us. And that's the common thread. An interior awareness, an examination, often, and perhaps always a celebration of experience, bad or good. So historically, poets have been a rarefied group. In the past, they were sort of the educated, rich, wealthy, the knobs of society, and then troubadours serviced the hoi polloi and the groundlings. But today that's changed. It's changed with mass education, but also with the human potential movement and Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We've sort of gotten to the point now where we're interested in our own human development. And so poets are flourishing. We're seeing this massive flourishing of poetry across all cultural classes and communities, and there's a huge resurgence in interest in poetry, especially in millennials and upcoming generations. So poetry is changing. It used to be that we concentrated on different styles and schools and beliefs about how poetry should be, but all bets are off now. All the rules have changed and been put aside, actually. And it's a free-for-all. And it's sort of become, we don't know what's good, but we know it when we see it, you know, like pornography. So we're seeing now what used to be the troubadours are interested in their oeuvre. You know, they're interested in telling their story. They're interested in sharing their experience with their audience, educating and spreading their version of the world. So there's a new sort of life being injected into poetry, really fueled by popular culture, but bringing it into ultimately the scholastic, quote-unquote, scholastic format and forms of poetry. So that's sort of a few words. And I'm going to read a couple of things. The first one's called Adagios. Number one, emerging. Mine is the briny blood of oceans, pulsing fathoms deep from shell-strewn bedrock floor. Flesh come and gone in fragrant soil, breath in vapor rising from the sea-specked sapphire sphere. Two, spring. Scampering April joy in wavelets tease and tweak the bay in moods that shift like mercury. A splint of molten silver splices the horizon, disappears, and I'm suspended in a momentary perfect wonder. Three, summer. Shards of sun explode and scatter spray splash bling off rollers billowing to shore, flaunting their magnificence for watchful skies. Like ballerinas on a tilted stage, each one spinning out her prima glory. Four, autumn. Seahawks glide in clear October, hover free on wind shear, search out shoaling fish once rich in our Atlantic. I seek out inner space, soar in still infinity, to loose constraints of churning tide, turning time. Five, winter. Thunderous, ice-slicked slabs of granite ocean heave in swells, smashing stones on drizzle-spattered sands under dazzled pale of winter clouds. I brace against encroaching chill, insurgent dark of afternoon. Six, axis. The night we listened to the fog bell, veiling rains ground down in slithering sheets on grasses blasted dry by early frost. In a dyad of two souls' surrender, resistance yields to urgency in the axis where shadows meet and come to rest. And the second one I'm going to read, it's called Awakening. A lot of my poetry is sharing experience of private meditative experiences of transcendence. So this is called Awakening. I'm untethered, set free, dissolved into a limitless expanse, infinite, untroubled limity. Everything lies now within me, in my care, sits in my hand, rests within my heart. I'm faint with love. The world appears in gold backlit filigree, nothing as a thing, all exultant process, resonance. A joyful jumble, resplendent chaos of activity, reveals itself in every leaf and rock, within the bark on every tree. I'm charged with tenderness for spiders, bugs, errant fools, banana slugs and frogs, every particle of blade and grass, each drifting cloud. Silence is raucous, secret, a rabble sung out loud, and stillness is a trick of eye and sensibility, charged with wit and vast activity. I found this place. I'll take you there with me. That's it. Thank you.
Pauline, that was lovely. And of course, you all agree she's got the most beautiful reading voice. It's lyrical and effervescent and soft, and it's just wonderful to listen to you. Thank you. We have a very accomplished, prominent poet amongst us, Carol Stone. Such a pleasure to have her support in the workshops on Monday. And Carol, for me, is the queen of narrative. So if there's an abstraction, or if she doesn't get it, you know, she marks it very clearly, like what needs to come out of the poem, and it's wonderful. And somehow I think she channels like Greta Garbo when she reads, because when she reads, she's got this deep, sultry voice, which you'll hear in a moment from now, and it's such a pleasure to hear her read. So now, Carol, distinguished professor of English and creative writing emerita, Montclair State University. Carol Stone's poetry collections include, ready, Late, Hurt the Shadow, American Rhapsody, Traveling with the Dead, All We Have Is Our Voice, which is her brand new book, which she's got literally the galley in her hand, which will be published in August. Her work has been nominated for the Pushcart Prize, and her poems have won second place twice in the Allen Ginsberg Poetry Contest. She received 3 fellowships from the New Jersey State Council on the Arts, and she divides her time between Springs, East Hampton, and Verona, New Jersey, and an occasional sprint to Mexico. Well, let's welcome Carol Stone.
Dee always gives such wonderful introductions, and we have to live up to them. This is the cover of the book, that this is the proof, and so I thought I would begin by reading one of the poems. They are all persona poems spoken in the voice of someone else. Frida Kahlo's The Broken Column, 1944. Nails tacked into the sheet draped around me from the waist down, as if I were in the gynecologist's office mourning the child I lost, my back bloody as the back of the penitents who corn-whip themselves, the column held to my chin like a gun about to go off, my naked breasts protrude from the brace tight around my ribcage. I'm sick of it, operation after operation, suffering I can't shake. My body survives in the sky, wisps of blue and the earth, an undulating green landscape of Mexico, whose contours I love, martyr, saint, muse, a woman with ordinary sorrows. And on August 26th at the Amagansett Library, I'll be giving a workshop for those who'd like to try and write a persona poem. And they're really fun to do because it takes you out of yourself for a change. So I'll be getting back into myself with art and longevity, and you'll immediately recognize the subject matter. The Lieblers, married 72 years, died today in Springs, East Hampton, 2 hours apart, ages 96 and 97. It's time to go, sweetie, Gerson said, still painting. He told Judith, she who made exquisite brocaded silver handbags carried by Jackie Kennedy, Princess Diana, Mrs. Bush, in the shape of fans, eggs, boxes, pigs. You could fit hardly anything into their tiny space, a lipstick, $100 bill, limited editions, which is what we all are in the end, like matching purses. The next poem is Ghazal, which is a Persian form in which you have to repeat the last word of each stanza, and the poet has to mention herself in the last line. Seven Highwood, Ghazal. In the East Hampton sky, an August moon signals summer's almost over under the full moon. In this house I grow old in, I listen to the ocean, tides pulled by this summer moon. Wild turkeys amble through my yard, box turtles inch across Old Stone Highway under the pock-faced moon. At Louse Point, barefoot, I tread in tide pools that pull me to pebbles gleaming like the silver moon. I pick a pebble up, slide it into my jeans pocket, pure and perfect, cherished like the pale moon. I'd like to lie down in the sand, nest like the osprey, returned from a country with a crescent moon. On the beach, each night's like a retirement party. Beer cans rattle, fires burn under the watchful moon. Is this the happiness I've longed for? A house near the sea where I look up at the faithful moon? How far I've come from childhood houses, the girl who searched for her parents in the distant moon. I wave to you, my lost moon, carol, singing Au Clair de la Lune. Yesterday, I went to hear a talk on Frank Sinatra at the East Hampton Library. It was loads of fun, and I had written a Frank Sinatra poem, and that's because I'm from New Jersey. Old Blue Eyes. When Frankie died, the nurse pulled the sheet over his head, and his last wife, Barbara, thought of his other wives and lovers. His daughters wanted his estate. The Newark Star Ledger's obit says he had cannoli delivered to his mother every Sunday. He who loved her eggplant parmesan, her clams posolipo, to the end of his days. At the Paramount, Bobby Soxers swooned over the skinny boy from Hoboken. His notes took flight like wings inside him. In my neighborhood salon, where I've had my hair cut for years, aging stylists who grew up in Italian North Newark speak with longing of Old Blue Eyes. He could have put his shoes under my bed any time, Marie says. And I think I probably have time for one more poem. Small Bites. As a girl, I ate a donut in small bites to make its sweetness last. Its sugar coating, a mother's softness I couldn't remember, a promise of love. I hid powdered sugar donuts in the back of a kitchen cabinet to savor when grown-ups were gone, when I ate as if loneliness could end. Thank you.
So Carol, living up to true to her form, always tells you a story, and she makes it look like it's an easy thing to do, but the crispness and the clarity are really very highly practiced art forms, which she is. So we as listeners, we could be lulled into the simplicity, thinking, "Oh, I could do that." But guess what? It's really a very unique style that Carol has honed for many, many years. So thank you so much. Our next reader will be Carol Sherman. Carol is also one of the regulars at the workshop, and she has her mastery is in clearing out the weeds from the clutter within a poem, and she's a very good editor, and she can get the job done very succinctly. That is what I notice about and appreciate when she modifies my poems. I appreciate that succinctness that she brings to the equation. And she's written two memoirs and has 8 books of poetry to her credit. She has been featured on radio, TV, and in bookstores, colleges, and art galleries, where she has done countless readings both nationally and internationally. Let's welcome Carol Sherman.
Thank you, Dee. Thank you all for coming out today. I have 2 poems. I'm going to start with one that's dedicated to my first poetry teacher, Alan Plants. I think some of you here knew Alan pretty well. A couple of summers ago, a whale had washed up on the shore in East Hampton, and it was a long walk out to the whale, and crowds were around. The whale was dead at that point, a young whale. But by the time I got back to my car, this poem was written in my head. And it was a gift, and it's dedicated to Alan, who was a wonderful poet and a great maritime poet. He loved the sea, and he was a captain of a boat. The title of the poem is Whale Rider. I had spent too many months in the mountains of Mexico. The dry air, the frigid nights, the sun fiery on my skin. I had forgotten the sea, the surf rolling in with a low roar, the spray anointing me. Your friend came looking for you today, a rendezvous set eons ago, when you swam together in the brine. But you had already gone, without escort, to a deeper place. Crowds watched her as she lay beached, the waves ruffling over her, a flipper raised in farewell again and again, a salute to her lover who had left without her. You had no gills or fins, but you might as well have. How you swam in the undertow with mermaids, sunbeams, sea fan. You breathed mist and salt, made us know your kingdom. And now, your friend lies dying on the beach, and you, already lost in the waves, the wind, the kiss of the sea holding you. She came to take you home where you were most alive. G mentioned the workshop process, and I have a grand expose of the poetry workshop, and it's called Poetry by Committee. People who've been in a workshop recognize Poetry by Committee. The elders assemble, sorcerers, witch doctors, brujas, midwives, armed with machetes, scalpels, magnifying glass, tweezers. They giggle and gossip in good humor as the first initiate ascends the wide steps of the pyramid, then is placed on the slab. The first elder proclaims, "The poem is terrific, but it needs to be cleaned up, of course. Some quick cuts with a scalpel, does, ands, buts, likes, spout out sloppily, spattering their robes." Wiping her eyes clear, the gaunt one says, "Now that we know what you are saying, it is obvious you have said it ungrammatically." Probing with tweezers, she pulls out dangling modifiers, nouns used as verbs, verbs used as nouns. "I can't stand ings, get rid of them," she invokes. Magnifying glass in hand, the tragic one laments, "I like it, but what does it mean?" A groan is heard from the altar. "It doesn't mean what you think it means, for I meant to say something else," she wails. The wise one whacks with the machete. She puts the top on the bottom, the middle at the end, and leaves out the beginning altogether. "Now it is in the right order," she nods. "Less is more, less is more," the elders chant. The Irish midwife reaches into the gore, giggling, her eyes are sparkling, and she pulls out a title. "And if you call it that, instead of this, it'll be a real fine poem now, don't you know?" The poet staggers down the pyramid, eyes glazed, wounds smarting, clutching the mangled masterpiece to her breast, smoothing their robes. Satisfied and flushed with pleasure, the elders laugh and call after her. "In the end, you're the poet. These are only suggestions." They eye each other gleefully. "Next, who's next?" they croon. Thank you.
Well, I didn't know we had to be mercenaries in order to go to a workshop. It's not as brutal as that. So that was wonderful. Carol really just gave us an inside glimpse at what it's like to be on the altar, on the slab, as she calls it, up the pyramid on the slab. But it's actually, I have found it's an amazing process, because when I'm done and I've got six, you know, edits, you know, visual edits, then it's, you know, then I'm in a field of bounty with very committed authors who are thinking on my behalf. So I find it an amazing experience. Our next reader will be Dan Hayes. Dan has given me the shortest bio in history, so let me try to elaborate a little bit. Dan, I consider him, and his son is here, and his daughter-in-law, and Susie, his girl, is here, and he is one of the last of the romantics. We know Walter. Walter is a romantic, but Dan is an outward romantic. He's in love with love. He's a Romeo. Dan is a Romeo when it comes to his poetry, and it always is refreshing and caressing. That's when you hear his poem or read his poem, it's like being caressed. It's a wonderful thing. And now here for his formal bio. Dan Hayes lives in East Hampton and writes poetry for himself and others' enjoyment. He formerly wrote and edited prose in New York and New Jersey for a variety of news outlets. Let's welcome Dan.
I don't think I'm going to live up to that introduction, because I didn't actually bring any romantic poems. This one's called Anatomy Study. You cannot dance to a tamponade or lovingly engage in a dorsalis pedis. Did those Greeks and Romans consider the romantic sound they would leave when providing medical nomenclature, naming these items eternally, creating a memory in the mystery of healing? For a student's study of fracture or disease, leaving them to appreciate subclavian mediastinum and the little alveoli so close to our heart. Reflections on a mountain. Down the peak I peer, admiring my son's athletic art, his smooth grace, precision stance. Elegantly he lines his skis, slicing the snow with manly precision. So much grown from the one-time tot who crawled at the mountain's base and munched at its whiteness, happy amid the flakes, a child conceived in love beside a frosty slope. This is a winter poem. It ain't over till it's over. Do not tell me summer is out of reach. The warmth continues on my beach. So many days I wish to swim. Don't say that winter's coming in. The sun is out. You see all ending. What will you forecast when it's raining? I'll enjoy each sunbeam that I see, like a cornstalk kissed by a honeybee. So what if it's slightly cooler now? I reject the cold. I will not bow. When seasonal visitors leave the shore, I'll dive right in. Enjoy waves more. I see the summer as always kind. I refuse to let it leave my mind. If drifts pile up like northern Canada, I'll go to the fridge for a margarita. The air may explode with torrents of snow, but I won't let golden memories go. Weather break. Should I call you Mother Nature? Would you rather be forced black? You tore down branches, pelted rain on my roof, sent brown leaves skittering across my deck. Gray was the color you turned the sky. Cold was the wind that buffeted my window. Then, as if you felt my complaint, you brought back warmly, blew away autumn for a day, let me float on a kayak out on the bay. So beautiful, I forgive you, such a kind respite. Today I accept dark skies again. The wet is okay, too. The old bench sat on the deck, lichen covered and faded. It just needs a fix-up, you said. I postponed as other items pressed, not knowing life's brevity then. The other day I took it out. I washed away the gray of time, carefully made it bright and white. What would you say if you could see it now? Why did I wait?
Thank you, Dan. Thank you. Our next reader will be Virginia Walker. Virginia comes all the way over from Shelter Island, so to me that's like a long way. Somehow they've mastered that commute on that island. Virginia received her PhD in British and American Literature from New York University. She's taught writing and literature courses at New England and Long Island colleges. At the National Council of Teachers of English, she's presented papers on speculative fiction by women, on propaganda and ethics in fiction, and on making poetry accessible to students. She's presented papers on the dystopian writings of Octavia Butler and on leadership in feminist novels to the Society for Utopian Studies. At the Community College Humanities Association, she spoke on how to present the Armenian genocide to students through multimedia. She addressed the 19th Century Studies Association on the rewriting of dream conventions by Victorian women novelists. She is the co-author of the poetry book Neuron Mirror with Michael Walsh, which has raised over $10,600 for the Lustgarten Foundation for Pancreatic Cancer Research. Her poems have appeared in Poets for Paris, Suffolk County Poetry Review, The Light of City and Sea, and The Humanist.
Ritual. A lone turkey struts on our back porch, picking at droves of sunflower seed shells, for we have been solacing the persistent birds all winter, and now it is spring. The last frozen piles of plowed snow are shrunken, dirty reminders of cold. Through the window, I can see a cluster of green fans. The ground vines are awake. I realize that this day of portent, I believed once when young and obedient, especially the clock at 3. I fasted in aspiration of the sacrifice, but I questioned always. Now the world is as miraculous, but pagan. I believe in the rise of green shoots from mold. I believe in the glory of my own existence. I know the absolutes of living, mortal and moral. A ritual of childhood compels me to dye ellipsoids, symbols of fertile life in beet juice, little suns in blood without the need for death. I do not slay the lone stalker to propitiate a god, but my own old fixated belief in heaven has a new virulent cascade in the world. The new rituals are destructive of human life, of all mortals who do not bow to the one true faith. That poem appeared in The Humanist for March, April, and Steven Pinker, the philosopher, was on the cover, which was kind of really great. And I'm going to wax a little philosophical in the next poem, almost epistemological, Hiking the Ridges. From a distance, the snow gleams in defiance of the warming climb. But when you approach, walking slowly on slippery rocks underfoot, you notice that the snow is an edifice sculpted by wind into pinnacles of iced strength standing in curious form. Where are you standing? Is this not the mind? And you explore a world within of rock, an internal planet of self? Your boots are now on air, and you still walk, for here, alone, you part nets of neurons, sealed to a scene of questing drama. Is your mind here, or are you the mind? Your arms move, your legs, you turn your head. You are a material spirit of many earths. Your mind inhabits all, every atom of desire, for you create yourself in every act, every thought. Choices hammer a contour. Your will inhabits decisions spelled in flesh. Your curious tabernacle is the unmelting self.
Visitor, one. I always talk to the dead, and perhaps I am already in a silent dialogue with you, although I am still struck with the unreality of the news delivered slowly by your mother. Stunned, I sit in my living room and face the window of early May. In the glass, at eye level, a glimmering beauty looks in at me, beak straight. Michael, I cry out in a child's voice, I want your spirit to be visiting me. I feed the hummingbirds every year, from May to September. They return luminous, bearing in their plumage the Caribbean as our azaleas bloom. But this one knows me. I see Michael's trickster self departing on the air. Two. The visitor comes again to me as what I must tell his family gathered at his library memorial. But how can I share with these unknown of his kin the sweet spirit I knew to him to be in all his living? Finally, I speak of another world, in the stars, an island where Michael has settled. There in that ideal of a child's imagination, he lives, wearing a hummingbird mask. Do I convince them of that place? Michael, I cannot convince myself. Yet you visit me again in weekly turns of your laugh, your impish cleverness. My mother visits daily, my father never so often. I am glad that you will fly at my eye in darting intervals. Nora's Dance, 1. July 1st noon is fireworks on skin. They are heavy with a sparking heat. My eyes are shuttering the blast of sulfur sun. A cool bath adds a cloying damp to clothes, but fails to bring relief. Only ice water, constantly sipped and held to temples, the glass rolled against my head, alleviates the thick weight of air, crackling with invisible coals. 2. When the stark new priest came to see them, as they contorted on the hay, where do they hide the Thrius, the women with matted hair? The frenzy dance was a remedy, they said, for the welt of the hairy wolf in the sheaves. Did the men who were not men believe it true? Even the stabbing widow who tells time could be thwarted by women in abandon? Old resurrection myths battle with new, all involve torture, death, and someone's rebirth. 3. If the sweat is pouring off me, and I gasp for air without need for dance, what poison have I kept without? I am bitten mad by an ancient yearning to hold the heat of a god within, and could kill a lover to cool my blood. And I'm going to close with this poem, kind of Shelter Island in the Winter. Curious running, blessed visit from a fox, nothing to feed this wild, sleek, long-tailed red spirit. Suddenly, he is there. I rise from my chair too late. Below freezing, the air is silent. Birds have left feeders. The squirrels vanished. Alert with hunger, the fox passes near the porch, running light on icy snow. His dark-tipped fur lengthens his outline. I wait at the glass door to sight him again. All is still. Then far in the field, I see him, swift, dark, alone, curious for life.
I am the last reader. My name is Dee Slavutin, and I wrote poetry in my 20s, left it for 40-plus years, and came back to it just a few years ago, so you can figure out how old I am. I've been privileged to be able to take the summers in the last few years to try to get to that quiet, silent place where a poem can be birthed, because it is a form of birth. I'll read some of the poems to you. So I'm going to be reading some poems from this first book, for which I have to thank Pauline and Barry for actually the design and the actual production of the book. The only thing I could take credit for is writing the poems. This book, by the way, is dedicated to my husband, Lee Slavutin, who's here in the audience. He's the one with the long beard. And the dedication says, "To Lee, the man who vowed to love me and to take out the garbage." And I spend some time thinking about which one of us will go first. I think we'll be married 40 years this year. If I'm wrong, don't correct me right now. I would like to not be here if Lee is not here, is basically where I'm going with this. So I'm going to read two poems about that subject. One of them is called "Kiss Me Goodnight." He will kiss me goodnight. It will be the last kiss, the kiss of twilight. Our 100 years, now a bygone song. His slippered footsteps quietly scrape away the loneliness. I confess his tenderness keeps me in this world. And so I go first. This is a must. Uncertainty may dictate, but I would not hesitate. And now, the contrary. What if it's not just not so? Because I don't get to call that shot. Left here. No sitting a spell, leaning on an elbow, while coffee steams sense into dreams and our talk affirms the divinity of pairing. Now I wade in sooted floods of thoughts on the ledge of a flat-edged earth. Everything was round, seamless, spun, turned and poured as though by a sacred hand. A restless night soothed by a warm shoulder. Splinters tended with delicacy. You're listening, quiet as daybreak. Even our bone marrow was married. A continuous certainty curled at the foot of our bed. Your key, turning in the door, told the world to wait outside as we circled into our own center. Now I lie rigid in bed, flat, the door tumbler, soundless as your ghost. I would like to sit again with you, breathe the air you breathed, turn this flatness into something round. In the preface of my book, I have a quote from Pierce Bierce Shelley. He wrote a treatise called In Defense of Poetry in 1821. He says, "A poet is a nightingale who sits in darkness and sings to cheer its own solitude with sweet sounds. His auditors are as men entranced by the melody of an unseen musician, who feel that they are moved and softened, yet know not whence or why." And this quote so moves me because the act of the writing, which Pauline really spoke about, is very much an experience of solitude. And the goal always is to create music that mankind, men and women, mankind, all of us, know not whence or why, but are so moved by it. So there's got to be that emotional moment in the poem. That's what I've been striving for. Sometimes you get it, sometimes you don't. That's how it goes. Will there be milk tomorrow? Yes, of course he's coming home. He only went for milk. The family eating dinner across the street on the 15th floor don't see me staring out my window, waiting. When he returns with whole instead of 2%, I rejoice for the added fat he brings. He has come home to me with a quart of milk. A tree. What is your prescription? In winter, you undress yourself. Silent nakedness does not shame you. To be ignored is of no consequence. Sculpted limbs, firm place. The vernal sun's thistled rustle succumbs you like a charmed snake, bribed belly dancer, shaking and shimmering, drinking too much rain. Heathen belly dancer, now dressed to strut. To learn from you, I run and put on my green sarong. Still, I built a Zen garden. It is very still there. I do not enter. Still hoping, still waiting, still planning. I enter to weed weeds, deem them unworthy. They choke the earth like thoughts. As I weed, I breathe the still, praise the still, be the still. I am in the garden. And I'll end with my signature poem. Some people have signature dishes, as chefs do. Maybe as poets, we can have a signature poem. But you'll not be surprised. It's related to the food industry. The name of the poem is called French Mustard. The mustard's been in the fridge for 3 years. My Dijon from France. I thought it would enhance the inside door. Guests might ask for something special, I would say. Why not take a chance on this mustard? It's from France. There's no expiration date. Pebbly, earthy hues look delicious. Go ahead and eat. I'll wash the dishes. Dab it on the chicken breasts. Pour a glass of white, cloth napkins on the left. Add a chunk of Beaufort cheese. We'll pretend we're in the Pyrenees. At a sidewalk table in front of a cafe, wondering if some men will look our way. We'll raise our skirts above our knees. Go ahead, look all you want, if you please. Have us all in a glance. Such imagination springs from the mustard jar from France.